Welcome to the Deep Dive. We're all about plunging into fascinating texts and, pulling out those hidden stories, the unexpected twists, and those crucial little linguistic details that can really change how you see things.
Definitely.
Today we're taking a deep dive into Genesis chapter 14, specifically verses 5 through 10.
A short section, but packed.
Exactly. It might look small, maybe even a bit obscure, but I promise you it is absolutely bursting with action, some really unexpected turns, and some brilliant linguistic stuff that shapes the whole story.
Yeah.
Our mission, like always, is to grab the most important nuggets of knowledge, the key insights from this ancient bit of writing. Think of it like a shortcut, getting you clued in on an epic battle you might have just skimmed over before.
Okay.
Okay, let's unpack this.
What's fascinating here, I think, is that this isn't just some dry record. It's not a shopping list of names.
Right.
It's a really carefully crafted narrative. You can tell there's purpose, there's intent behind pretty much every word.
Mm-hmm.
And this particular battle, which, yeah, people often just read past it quickly, it actually serves as this critical setup. It sets the stage for some major figures, major themes that just echo through the rest of the Bible.
Yeah, okay.
It's foundational, really. And once you kind of get it, it lights up so much of what happens later.
And it kicks off with some serious action, doesn't it? Verse 5, you jump right in.
Yeah, straight in.
It's this huge military campaign. Jerlomer and his coalition of kings just sweeping through. The text says, basically, in the 14th year, Chertolomer and the kings with him came and struck the Rephaim.
Struck them?
Yes, yeah, struck, that Hebrew verb. It means they struck or they smote, but it feels much bigger than just a hit.
Oh, yeah. It's heavy.
It's powerful, definitive. It's almost like a formula for just, total crushing defeat, like ancient ESPN highlights, maybe decisive moments.
Huh. Yeah, something like that. It signals conquest, not just a fight.
And look who they hit first. The Rephaim in Ashtaroth Karnaim. Now, for an ancient audience mentioning the Rephaim, that immediately flags something big.
Absolutely. These weren't just, your average villagers.
No. They had this reputation, often linked with giants or these mighty, almost legendary warriors. You even see them mentioned elsewhere, like in Deuteronomy.
Right. So hitting them first.
It's a statement piece. Chedorlaomer isn't just conquering a town. He's taking down legends. It shows overwhelming, almost sort of mythical power right from the start.
That's a really crucial point.
Yeah.
Choosing the Rephaim first, it just broadcasts the sheer power of this coalition.
Mm.
They aren't picking off the easy targets. They're going straight for the intimidating big guys in the region. It's like saying, yeah, we're that dominant.
Totally.
And the story just keeps building that feeling of an unstoppable force. You get this relentless, almost like a travel map of terror.
Aha, uh-huh. Yeah.
It just piles up names and places. The Zuzim in Ham, the Emim in Shevet Kiriatham, the Horites down in Mount Seir.
It keeps going.
And what really drives it home is the rhythm, the repetition of Ed. That little Hebrew word, Ed.
Anything as far as...
And it just repeats, Ed Mount Seir.
Yeah.
Ed El Paran. It's like this drum beat in the text.
Right, like marking the checkpoints of their conquest.
Exactly. It emphasizes this continuous, unwavering movement. Further and further, a relentless march. There's no question about their might. It really makes you feel that inexorable advance.
That repetition, hiku.
Hiku, hiku, yeah. Then Ed. It does more than describe it. It almost like performs it for you. Paints that picture.
Yeah, it leaves an impression.
It really does. Okay, so they've done all this sweeping conquest, this destruction. And then, verse 7, here's where it gets really interesting. Chedorlaomer's forces, they turned back. The Hebrew verb is hub. It means return, turn back.
Okay, seems straightforward enough.
Well, yes, but there's this layer of irony here, isn't there? Because
yeah.
That root, shub, it's the same one used later for really important religious ideas.
Ah, like repentance, returning to God. Exactly. Turning from sin towards righteousness. A really positive spiritual turning.
Right.
But here, these kings, they're not turning back for any kind of spiritual reflection.
Not likely, no.
They're literally just turning around on their path of destruction to go smash more people.
Mm.
Specifically, the Amalekites and the Amorites. It's such a stark contrast. The same word root, but used for this kind of twisted sense of turning back just to continue the violence.
It really is a subtle but, yeah, profound linguistic irony. And if we connect this to the bigger picture,
yeah,
that mention of the Amalekites,
yeah,
that's a fantastic bit of foreshadowing, or maybe like narrative seeding.
How so?
Well, we know from much later in the Bible, right?
Yeah.
Amalek becomes this fierce, persistent enemy of Israel.
Yeah.
Almost the archetypal enemy.
Okay, yeah, I remember that.
But here, Genesis 14, they're just another group getting stomped by Chedorlaomer's army, introduced almost casually. So the text is subtly weaving these future enemies into the story now, giving you a little hint of conflicts way down the line, long before Israel is even really a nation.
Wow.
For an ancient audience who knew about Amalek's later role, this brief mention would add immediate layers of meaning. It suggests these events aren't isolated. They're part of a much bigger unfolding story.
Like threads being woven in early on.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's pretty masterful how they build that anticipation and context.
That is powerful. The idea that every little detail might be doing that kind of work, laying groundwork. Okay, so speaking of shifts, the narrative takes a turn itself here.
Mm-hmm.
We've been watching this like unstoppable force from Mesopotamia, but now the focus pulls right back to the local scene, different players.
The home team, sort of.
Yeah, the local kings who are about to try and make a stand. So after the Chedorlaomer steamroller, the drama shifts. Verse 8 gives us this grand roll call. All the local guys from the Jordan Plain. Then the king of Sodom, the king of Gomorrah, the king of Admah, the king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, which the text notes is Zoar.
Quite the list.
And if you hear it in Hebrew, there's this rhythm, Hamale, 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 the king, the king, the king. It sounds almost, I don't know, theatrical.
A bit pompous, maybe.
Maybe. Or, like you said, a doomed little league team lining up, trying to look tough against the pros.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I like that image. Because they are making a show of force, but you already sense it's probably futile.
And it says they drew up in battle array in the Valley of Siddim.
And that phrase, drew up in battle array, the verb there is erech.
Okay.
Which means arrange or line up.
Okay.
What's telling is that same root. It's used later for arranging the special bread in the tabernacle.
Oh, wow. So like a really formal, almost ritualistic lining up.
Exactly. A solemn, careful preparation. But here, it's a solemn lineup for war. A formal arrangement for what's about to be a complete disaster.
So it implies this order that's about to just shatter.
Pretty much. And then verse 9 really nails the drama. Four kings against five. Arba Melechim et Demiosha.
Sounds like a movie poster.
Doesn't it? The Hebrew really emphasizes it, this dramatic statement of the odds. Which, this raises an important question.
What's that?
What does this seemingly close matchup, four against five, actually mean for their chances?
Right. Numerically, it doesn't sound that bad.
But given what we just heard about Chedorlaomer wiping out the Rephaim and marching relentlessly,
okay. The
text is strongly hinting that this is like a false hope, a delusion of being evenly matched.
So the numbers are almost irrelevant against that kind of power.
I think that's the implication. It sets up this tension, this idea they might fight back, but you suspect it's not going to end well.
And that suspicion pays off pretty quickly and messily. Verse 10, the infamous Valley of Siddim.
Ah, yes, the tar pits.
Described as full of bitumen pits. The Hebrew is Beret Tamar, literally wells of sticky tar or slime pits.
Doesn't sound like good terrain for a battle or a retreat.
Not at all. You can almost picture it, right?
Right.
Bubbling asphalt, potholes everywhere. Treacherous ground.
Definitely.
And the description of the flight, the retreat, is just brutal. The kings of Sodom and Gomorrah, they flee in panic and fall right into these pits.
Eggs.
Talk about an embarrassing end. Not just defeated, but literally stuck in tar, bogged down by their own land. It's almost, wow, tragically funny.
It really is. There's this element of, like, dark slapstick comedy right in the middle of this violent story.
Yeah.
It's very cinematic, a really vivid, ironic end for these supposedly mighty city kings who just made that big show of lining up with Orek.
Right. The solemn arrangement leads to this.
Exactly. It underlines the bigger point.
Mm-hmm.
These powerful local rulers, totally outmatched, not just by the invaders, but by their own geography.
They literally sink.
They're no match at all. They can't even run away properly. It strips away all their dignity, highlights their complete lack of control, its military defeat, and total humiliation.
Wow. What a ride through just, what, six verses?
Yeah, it covers a lot of ground, narratively speaking.
And bringing all those linguistic bits together really paints the picture. You've got Hiku, they struck, showing the invaders' power as far as that relentless march.
The drum beat.
Yeah. Then the ironic Shub turned back, but for more destruction.
Yeah.
the rhythmic homily, the king for that doomed local roll call, leading to Arek, their formal but futile lineup.
Solemn setup.
Then the dramatic Arbamu, 4 against 5, that false tension.
Movie poster.
And finally, Burakar, the tar pits, sealing their sticky, humiliating fate. So what does this all mean, this whole sequence of chaos and humiliation? What's the point in the bigger story, especially thinking about who isn't on stage yet?
You've summed it up perfectly. All of it, the detailed chaos, the steamrolling invasion, the completely embarrassing defeat of the local kings, it serves this really crucial narrative purpose.
Okay.
It's a powerful prelude. It's designed specifically to set the stage for the real hero, for Abram.
Ah, right. He's still off screen during this battle.
Exactly. The man of faith, the guy living in tents, he hasn't even shown up in this part of the fight yet. But by showing how spectacularly these other heroes, these kings, fail.
They don't just fail, they get stuck in tar.
Right. They're utterly humiliated.
Mm.
The story creates this vacuum of leadership, this picture of total disarray and helplessness among the established rulers.
Which makes Abram's eventual success even more striking.
Precisely. His intervention, when it comes, isn't just effective. It looks almost divinely significant by comparison. It highlights that human power, military strategy, grand lineups, none of it was enough.
Mm.
So this deep dive really shows how these ancient writers used every tool they had, specific words, vivid images, the structure of the story itself, to build anticipation, establish the context, and basically shine a spotlight on the hero's future importance even before he steps into the scene.
Every little detail, every word choice is working towards that, preparing us.
Yeah, it's all there for a reason.
Yeah.
Preparing us for the true protagonist.
It's amazing how much depth is there. Genesis 14, verses 5 to 10 seems like a simple passage. But when you really look closely at the language, the structure, it just opens up.
It
goes from maybe a dry battle report to this really rich, layered, compelling story. Giants, irony, tar pits, all coming alive through these Hebrew words and the way the story's told. It really shows how paying attention to those details can completely transform your reading.
Indeed. And maybe it leaves us with a final thought, something for you, the listener, to chew on.
Aww.
Consider how often those seemingly minor details or specific word choices in any story, ancient texts, sure, but also modern novels, movies, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
How often might they be subtly setting you up, preparing you for the main character's entrance, or for a big turning point?
Like little clues hidden in plain sight.
Exactly. What might you start looking for now? What new questions could you ask about other stories you encounter, knowing just how much meaning can be packed into those small, deliberate choices the storyteller makes?
That's a great takeaway. It encourages you to be a more active reader, always digging a little deeper.
Yeah, always looking beyond just the surface plot.